For more than 20 years, I have explored the most remote regions of the world. Places where most people wouldn't go, that's what has always driven me in my field. I discovered a new lemur species that is now the world's smallest primate. It's an amazing example of how little we still know about what's out there. I'm looking for really good, scientifically sound evidence where we could finally put this to rest and maybe have Bigfoot walk off the pages of myth and legend.
What the f- is that?
From the haunted heartland in Omaha, Nebraska, my name is Brian Corey, and I welcome you one and all to this episode of the Necronomicast. My guest tonight for a late-night conversation is Dr. Maria Mayer, the world-renowned primatologist, explorer, and award-winning television host. She was National Geographic's first female wildlife correspondent. She's hosted dozens of documentaries and now currently stars in Travel Channel's hit series, Expedition Bigfoot. She is not your typical scientist. Maria is known for exploring the most remote regions of the Earth in search of elusive, rare, and little-known animals. In fact, she discovered the world's smallest primate, a brand new species to science in remote Madagascar. So, Bigfoot hunters, dim the lights and relax as I welcome to the program Dr. Maria Mayer. And now, calling in on the Necronomicast hotline, from Miami, Florida, I am so excited to welcome to the program Dr. Maria Mayer. Maria, how are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I am beyond excited to have you on the program. Bigfoot has been a real interest of mine ever since I was a little boy. And my background is not one of science. I studied music in college, so I don't have I don't have the academic scientific background nor any experience with like this specialized discipline that you've worked so hard to acquire in your distinguished career. I approach the subject of Sasquatch pretty much, and all explained phenomena with kind of a philosophical approach. So I have great respect for you and for you to be spending this time with me tonight for this conversation about this mystery. It's very generous of you, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you. I'm super excited to talk to you about it. And unlike you, I didn't have a fascination with Bigfoot growing up. I was obsessed with animals and basically had a zoo at home, which is how I got onto my career path of working in the wilds. But Bigfoot is something that is, other than hearing the lores, you know, throughout growing up, this is a brand new area for me.
With all your colleagues in the scientific world, have you had much ribbing or teasing or anything like that? Or does your reputation kind of make them back off a little bit when you sign on to do an expedition for this creature?
I mean, in all honesty, it has been a mixed bag of reactions. I've had some colleagues from the scientific community be upset about my involvement in this search. They feel that it's a waste of time and money that could be used, let's say, for conservation efforts of animals that we do know are out there and exist. And on the flip side of that, I've also had colleagues that I respect very highly reach out to me, mostly in private, to say how thrilled they are that I've decided to take part in this search because it's something that they've always been incredibly interested in and that has never been given the serious scientific attention that it deserves. So it's been a bit of a mixed bag on that kind of reaction.
So yeah, over hundreds and hundreds of years, there's been thousands upon thousands of these reports. And there's been, you know, just throughout time, so many reports and eyewitness accounts and folklore and everything. So I think that it is important to at least gather what data you can. And even if there is no evidence, that's data in itself.
Correct. And what I say to people who don't support, let's say, my involvement in this is that the very reason that I was interested in science is because of the capability of being able to answer questions that remain unanswered, and that sort of insatiable curiosity that it takes to really keep you on track on a very challenging and difficult expedition. It's knowing that the payoff could be a massive discovery that would really further our scientific knowledge of any given area. And so the truth is that that holds in this case as well. Here we have a potential creature that for centuries, Native Americans, all of who have different languages and dialects, all have a different name for it, but their stories are all consistent and the same. There's tens of thousands of eyewitness accounts from all over the country of people that, quite frankly, have a lot more to lose than to gain by sharing their stories and their encounters. And so the way that I look at it is, if even one of those stories, or maybe I'll flip that, if all of those stories are not true and just one of them is, then it's still worthy of pursuit. And for me, the most important thing as a scientist is to keep an open mind and to really explore the unknown. And you never know on these expeditions, and it has happened to me in the past, I co-discovered the world's smallest primate in Madagascar while we were searching for a much larger known primate. So it's not to say that we're going to find the answers that we're looking for, but the great thing is about exploration is that even if you don't find that answer, you could find answers to other questions you weren't even asking. And so I think there's always value in that.
Now, you mentioned that you were the co-discoverer of the world's smallest primate in Madagascar, a species of lemur, and you weren't looking for that initially. What led you down the road to find this lemur? Was there any kind of... was there anything maybe kind of like Bigfoot, like in terms of folklore? Like, did you hear stories or did you find evidence that didn't lead you directly to this small creature? Were there things that led you to find it rather than just, oh my gosh, what is that?
Well, I suppose it's a mixture of the two, because it was an oh my God, what is that moment for sure. So I had been working in Madagascar for several years. In fact, my entire career, which is kind of what makes this such a perfect fit. I feel like I've been working for this my entire life without knowing it. But my entire career has been about going out to search for rare and elusive animals. And so there were several lemur species in Madagascar that were said to be on the verge of extinction. And no one had ever studied them. And in fact, several of them had never even been photographed. So I set out to find those lemurs and worked in Madagascar for a number of years. And it was during an expedition in searching for one of those lemurs and doing long-term studies on them that my colleague and I, Dr. Ed Lewis from Omaha Zoo, were on this expedition. And we looked at these guidebooks, and they each talked about a little lemur species that lived in this forest, but they gave different accounts of what was there. And so we decided to try and, confirm which guidebook was right. And so we set up these small, they're called Sherman mammal traps. And basically you bait them, let's say, with a little bit of banana, and an animal runs in. And then in the morning you check the traps, you look in, and then you release them. Well, we did that for several weeks and we got all the, let's say, usual known suspects in there. And one particular very rainy morning, I looked inside one of the traps and these huge eyes were peering back up at me. And I realized that it looked nothing like what either one of those guidebooks described, and that what we had in there was something totally new. Of course, you can't just claim it's new and be done with it. I then had to go back on several expeditions and capture dozens of them. And of course, I always say release them back into the wild. But we took genetic samples and we ran those samples in a lab back in the States and confirmed our suspicions that in fact, this was a brand new species to science.
Amazing. And you mentioned you had a colleague from the Omaha Zoo.
Yes.
Have you been to the Omaha Zoo?
Many times. In fact, that's where I carried out a lot of the genetic work in my PhD thesis.
Amazing, because this show, I don't know if you were told, but this show broadcasts, records, is produced in Omaha, Nebraska.
No way. I did not know that.
Yes.
Seriously. Oh my gosh, that is so funny. So people then would know if they're listening in Omaha that I stayed in the little hotel across the street from the Omaha Zoo for many months while I was finishing up my PhD.
Fantastic. Well,
trying to confirm a new species to science.
I was going to ask you at some point in this conversation if you've ever heard of the Omaha Zoo, and you're old friends with us here.
Yeah, no, highly recommended. It's a beautiful zoo, and more than that, the work that they do for the wild counterparts of the animals that are in the zoo is pretty much unparalleled. It's really incredible, all of the conservation projects that they're involved in and that they support.
I'm glad to hear that you've had such a positive experience at the zoo and our zoo.
What a small world!
I know, right? And it keeps getting smaller. It's a fantastic zoo, and it keeps getting better. I haven't been there yet this calendar year yet, but they're opening up another exhibit and just all these things. It's really exciting. So I'm so glad that you've had such a positive experience here. Now you've mentioned conservation, and with this creature that you found, this small lemur. When I hear about new animals being discovered or scientists find this or that, I'm always kind of worried or sad that they might have to, you know, put it down in order to study it thoroughly. Mm-hmm. Did you have to do anything like that with this new creature?
So that was something that was also hugely conflicting to me, because as you mentioned, in order for the scientific community to accept that you have in fact described a new species, the expectation is that you put two type specimens, a male and a female, down, that is then housed at a museum so that other scientists and researchers can then go back and analyze, you know, your findings. And I wasn't at peace with that. Mm. And I, in fact, completely refused to do that. And so the compromise that was made is that, in fact, we collected one male and one female that are very much alive to this date and living at the local zoo in Madagascar, where basically for educational and conservation purposes, you know, kids visit every day, tourists learn about them. It encourages that sort of, if you know something, you love it, you want to protect it, and they're still alive. And when those individuals die from natural causes, then they will be housed at a museum as type specimens.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great. That puts my mind at ease. When we start talking more about the Bigfoot phenomenon, there's always this segment of the enthusiasts and the researchers that think that you have to put one down. We have to have a corpse. We have to have an autopsy. And I'm going to not get into the paranormal or the strange parts of the Bigfoot phenomenon when I have you on the line. But I still think, regardless of any of that, it's such a mystery and such a magical creature in terms of its, how elusive it is, just everything about it that we don't know, that I think it would be such a shame to, you know, put one down just for the sake of.
I mean, I like I said, I have an issue with that across the board. And I don't believe there will ever be a time in my scientific career, if I were to discover any new species to science, that I would ever take its life. I just think that it's time for science to catch up with what we know. What we know is right from wrong. I think there was a time, as we all know, where explorers set off into new worlds and to document everything that they were finding and catalog it, they were shooting them down. We know better than that now. We also know that habitats are decreasing and that numbers of animals are very limited. And we know that these are all animals in their own right are incredibly intelligent, sentient, and in many cases, emotional beings with a family structure. And all of these things, I think, require our respect. And if anything, if you discover a new species, your main priority should be to protect it, not take out any individuals.
Thank you for mentioning that, for sure. I know some people haven't been able to see the end of Expedition Bigfoot season two because it's on Travel Channel right now, but I saw them all on Discovery Plus, and there's a lot of correlation with the evidence that you found between supposed or alleged Bigfoot creatures and the chimpanzee species.
Mm-hmm.
So you were just talking a second ago about social structure dynamics, relationships in the chimpanzee world. I've even heard that they have their own culture or politics even. Can you elaborate a little bit on that from what I've read?
Sure. So, I mean, Jane Goodall has very famously talked about chimpanzee culture, and there's been books written about chimpanzee politics, which I have to tell you are as, let's say, notorious and warfare-like as human politics, I suppose, especially this day and age.
Right.
It's pretty cutthroat. And I don't think that it should really surprise us anymore. I think for so long, humans have, you know, we've thought of ourselves as being at that top of that food chain, or at the very least, that top of that intelligence chain. And I think that the more studies that have come out, like, for example, the first time we knew that apes were using tools, as you know, a Homo habilis, right? We'd have to basically redefine either what we talk about as tools or redefine humans, right? Because we're no longer the tool maker. Other animals also do this. The same thing goes for these cultures. You'll see where different populations, and we'll use chimps as an example, will teach each other a certain practice that then you don't see in other populations. And so that's how we're seeing the different cultures that are taking place across different chimpanzee communities. That can also be said of gorillas, we now know, especially the Western lowland gorillas, which are the ones that you see at zoos, but they're actually the ape that we know least about in the wild. And it's only been until very recently that we've been able to conduct any kind of long-term behavioral studies, because it took well over 14 years to habituate those animals to humans. Mm. So any data that we were collecting before that wasn't really that sound, because most of the time they were trying to flee and run. Their social structures are quite complex. Their social relationships are incredibly complex. You have chimpanzee populations that will organize a hunt where you have drivers and catchers and a leader. And everyone has a role and a stake during that hunt. This isn't just kind of there's actually, like, if you think about a football game, or, you know, there's a plan, there's a game plan in place, and they're really thinking about how to drive an animal into the hands of the chimp that's waiting to catch it on the other end. So they're pretty sophisticated when they do these things.
When you mention these things and you're talking about them using tools and everything, has this always been the case, or is it increasing, or is it something that we're just now discovering more with our investigative techniques?
Well, I think that's very hard to say I think the onset of long-term studies on the great apes isn't, in relative terms, all that long a history. Western lowland gorillas, for example, were only discovered in the wilds about 120, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really, and that's just when we discovered them. We really haven't learned what we're going to know about them until really just recently. And we're still at the very, very beginnings of that. So I think that what it really entails is long-term presence in an area. Like, for example, you know, you've got Jane Goodall with the long-term chimp studies. You've got Baruti Galdikas with the orangutans. And of course you had Diane Fossey with the mountain gorillas. Mm-hmm. And it's being there, I call it muddy boots conservation, but it works for just research as well. being there day in and day out is what is really going to give you that cutting edge of observing new behavior. And honestly, behavior that could very much go unnoticed unless you're out there from the time they wake up to the time that they, you know, bed down.
Yeah. What I'm trying to kind of lead us down is that everything that we know about the planet Earth, it's so wonderful that there's so much that it is unknown. And even in our—
Oh, absolutely.
And even in our own country, with bears, you know, I was reading that bears, they have generational dens, perhaps for hundreds mm-hmm. of years, and we don't know where all these dens are. So to go out and to mm-hmm. and to go out and look for evidence of a primate that's roaming around, all over the world, but you guys with your expedition in North America, amazing.
Well, that's— And I give lectures for National Geographic around the country all the time, and that's one of the things that I always make a point of saying, especially to the younger, you know, kid audiences, is that there is still so much that we don't know, especially about the natural world, and so much left to discover. And so the idea today is that, you know, if you need an answer, you just look it up on Google, and there it is. And right. those are all, you know, we kind of know everything that's out there. And the fact is that there are new discoveries being made every day, especially when it comes to the field of exploration and the sciences. And fortitude and perseverance is the only thing that really keeps that going. But I think knowing the importance of it, meaning the why keep pressing on, knowing that there is so much potential for discovery and still so many things that are unknown, is to me one of the biggest driving forces.
As we get into now the production and your exploration, your expedition looking for Sasquatch, I watched all the episodes, very enjoyable. And I really appreciate the fact that you are on there with your reasoned scientific approach, because, and I know they're good friends of yours, and I'm not, because mm-hmm. I see a lot of myself in your cohorts that are on the show in terms of being a Bigfoot enthusiast. But you have like your scientific method that's very disciplined, very trained on the academic side. You're not going to go charging up the hill looking
right. Like, it's so funny. That comes up so much. People were really mad at me for getting mad at Ronnie for doing that. And they one comment I read on Facebook the other day said, she obviously doesn't like Ronnie at all. And I'm like, I had to laugh because I just got off the phone with Ronnie 5 minutes ago. Like, we're really close friends. And I love Ronnie's, you know, enthusiasm and excitement. And I get it. He's sort of like a kid out there fulfilling a dream. Like, he really, really more than anything wants to find this creature and, mm-hmm. and answer his own questions, right, from his experiences. What I say to that is, you know, I've been on hundreds of expeditions in the wild. This was not that I don't like Ronnie. What I can tell you about those expeditions, when you're working with wild animals, especially ones that are, you know, elusive and trying to remain hidden or unhabituated, is that only bad things can come from charging an animal like that. Mm-hmm. Either it's a threat to them, and so they're going to attack, or it's a perceived threat and they're going to run. And so we didn't want either of those outcomes. And that's why I got upset with him, because had that been a typical expedition that I lead, let's say in search of Western lowland gorillas or, you know, any other sort of animal out there, the last thing, in fact, when we try to habituate gorillas, we have to push boundaries a little bit to get them comfortable with us being there. But the last thing you want to do is push so hard that you drive them off. And if we're basing, and here's the thing about, you know, Bigfoot, there's no book on Bigfoot. Like, no one is a Bigfoot expert, right? A lot of people say, no one is a Bigfoot expert, because if that were the case, we'd have tangible, irrefutable evidence. So if we're basing this off eyewitness accounts and reports, and so the idea that this could be some sort of hominid or ape-like creature, then we have to use the methods that are scientifically sound and proven in trying to elicit something that's going to give us the evidence we want. Because the other thing I said to Ronnie, and by the way, like we were good about 2 minutes after that whole scene. So just if you're listening and you're one of those people who thought that I don't like Ronnie, like nothing could be further from the truth. We're kind of like Mulder and Scully, right? Like we're really good friends. We just have different takes and approaches. That's all. No, it was, you know, I get it. It was an exciting night. He thought like, oh my gosh, if I run up this hill, if I charge up that hill, I'm going to see it. But here's so the last bit to that is, let's suppose that was true. And that's the other part I was trying to explain. So what? Lots of people say they've seen it. That's not going to solve the dilemma of having real tangible evidence. So thank you for bringing that up.
Oh yeah. And I've talked to a lot of television personalities on this show, television personalities that are on like paranormal shows. And every one of them says like, you know, we're in a haunted or an allegedly haunted location for days. So 72, 100 hours. And then they film all that, multiple camera angles, multiple things. And then they have to edit that down to a 22 or a 42 minute show. So, and you're at the mercy of editors. So like about the production, and then I want to get into evidence, but this is very
interesting. Which is scarier than any expedition I've ever been on. Cause you are at the mercy of the editors. And I can only say thank goodness that I love and trust our team, our production team. Mm-hmm. Maybe the best crew seriously that I've ever worked with. And they take this, you know, really seriously and with a lot of respect. And, you know, obviously they want the show to be entertaining, but what we're doing and what we're finding out there is what we're doing and what we're finding out there. But like you mentioned, so Ronnie and I, let's say, are out there for, several weeks at a time. We are out in the woods trekking, a minimum of 12 hours a day. And so then what you see is that tiny snippet of that 12-hour day, right? In that right. moment. And so it just looks like, oh my God, the crazy doctor is mad at poor Ronnie. And I'm like, wait, we just had a few laughs before that. You just didn't see that.
Sure.
And
sure.
then right after.
Well, yeah. Like I said, you film for hundreds of hours and then it's edited and assembled. So I was just wondering, are you in like a conversation with the editors or the producers whose job it is to edit, you know? So have you ever watched like your show and you're like, mm-hmm. and as a scientist, you're like, well, that was important. You should have put that in there, or you didn't put that in there enough. Or why did you put that in there? That's scientifically, that doesn't hold water. Do you ever have those conversations? Like this is evidence. You need to put this in there instead of focusing on this.
Well, so we have an amazing showrunner who oversees the edits and that I talk to nearly on a daily basis, probably much to his horror. Mm-hmm. But I do stay on top of all that stuff. And look, I'll be honest, are there moments where I cringe because I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, that was, some way that it was edited where I feel a little bit like, yeah, sure. I mean, and I think that anyone who's ever done a TV show will tell you mm-hmm. that's just unavoidable.
Sure.
But to be honest with you, were it not for the utmost care and professionalism that they have in editing the show, I would have never returned for another season. I feel that they do want the scientific evidence to shine and to be delivered in the most accurate way possible. And they constantly call me to check and double check certain things and make sure, you know, that they interpreted, you know, whatever result or description, anything that we've said, they want to double check and make sure that that's what we meant and that that's accurate. So I'm very lucky in that I can trust them and just sort of, you know, go out there and do my thing and know that when that footage gets back, that they're going to be, you know, careful in how they put that together and present it. Because it's like you said, I mean, editors, the edit room holds a lot of power. They can cut things and take words out and kind of slice it up any way they like. But the truth is that I feel that this, you know, I don't watch a lot of TV in general. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that I'm super familiar with all the Bigfoot shows and all of that stuff that's been out there.
Right.
But my understanding is that what sets this show apart is the different approaches of the team members, you know, the fact that we all come at it from a very different, you know, skill set and angle. But also that we are taking it seriously. We're not, you know, just joking around out there and making light of it. Because, like I said, the eyewitness stuff to me is probably the most important part of what we do. I get hundreds of letters from people a week sharing very personal stories about encounters they've had. Mm-hmm. Some of them saying, you know, I'm 60 years old now. I've never shared this with anyone, including my wife of 30 odd years, because I've been too embarrassed, but it's time. And I feel like you'll treat this seriously. Mm. And these people are professionals. They're military, they're psychologists, they're teachers, they're doctors, they're attorneys, and they have so much to lose and so little to gain by trusting me with their story and by sharing it with us, right? So I think that it's important that, you know, the science always comes first. I mean, the great thing about TV, and I've always thought this, and one of the reasons that I went into science communication is that, you know, you can have an entertaining TV show, but still, you know, have teachable moments, right? Where the audience is being educated about a subject or about science in a way that it doesn't feel like a lesson. It feels entertaining. It's light. They're enjoying themselves. But you're learning something. And I tend to think that the show is able to do that because people are able to see what the scientific method is or how I apply it anyway from my other, you know, typical expeditions to something like this.
I'm glad you brought all that up. I made some bullet points here, the different evidence that you guys collected over the different seasons, and separately, just on their own, individually, mm-hmm. It's like, well, okay, you can explain that away, but just when you when you compound it, like you have sound recordings, including infrasound, you have mm-hmm. Eye shine 8 feet off the ground, thermal images, mm-hmm. footprints, hair samples, mysterious balls of light, smells, perceived nests, these unusual structures where there's order in a forest, where there usually is no order, recorded vocalizations. I mean, when you kind of go down this list of all the evidence that you put together, there's quite a bit there that you guys are scientifically collecting and presenting.
Yeah. So it's funny because, my teammates would very much say that there's a lot of evidence, and I prefer to refer to it as, findings.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure that any of them in and of itself would hold up as scientific evidence. And there are a number of moments, sometimes multiple, even throughout just one field day, where I'm baffled and where I think, wow, I know what I just witnessed. I know, you know, and there's no, quick explanation or scientific explanation that I can think of for what we've just seen, in the field. And I don't think that you can just dismiss that either. I think that there are things that science can explain, at least maybe not yet. So I think that there's some remarkable findings. For example, during the filming in Kentucky, when we were in the Appalachian Highlands, I collected some eDNA from soil under a massive tree structure that we found. And I say tree structure, you can't see me do the little quotes, air quotes, right? but that's what Ronnie said. And I'll be honest with you, Ronnie had been talking about these tree structures that other witnesses and Bigfoot researchers describe. And for the longest time, I kept looking out for these thinking, I'd say, is that what you mean? Is that a tree structure? And he'd say, no. And anyway, when I saw this thing, because I came across it before Ronnie walked up, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, that's what Ronnie meant by tree structure, because it was so massive and different. And as you, I think, kind of quoted me in there saying, it was order mm-hmm. in a world of disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing about the woods if you look around, everything is disorderly in a sense. You know, there's underbrush and leaves everywhere and branches fallen and just a mishmash of stuff. And it's the order that generally catches your attention, something that looks intentional or out of place because it's so kind of perfectly in place. And this thing certainly fit all that criteria. And so it became an area of interest while we were there. So I collected some soil from underneath it, and we sent that out to a lab in UCLA for analysis. And I've got to tell you, in fact, we sent several samples, not just from there, but this sample is what really raised an eyebrow because, and let me tell you, the geneticists there were pretty shocked as well.
Yeah.
I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but it came back with some pretty interesting findings. I don't know if I'm allowed to say at this point, meaning some people haven't watched it now that it's back on Travel Channel.
Right.
But if you've seen it on D Plus, then you know what I'm talking about. And you would not expect to have this sort of DNA in the wilderness in Kentucky. So it was pretty shocking.
Yeah, you say there are no native primates here.
Correct.
Like that.
So you wouldn't expect to find that really in any North American woods, right? But when you look at the breakdown, you know, given this unusual find and couple that with it's under another unusual find, which is this intricately built, let's call it tree structure thing, yeah. Right?
Sure.
And then you keep adding the layers of the other finds that we had in and around that area. You know, frankly, it like I said, I'm very open-minded. And it does make you raise an eyebrow as to, you know, what's out here? What did that?
And for my brain, what's the difference between eDNA, the environmental DNA, and other DNA?
So the environmental DNA is the genetic material that's naturally left behind by animals in the environment. And what the scientific analysis of these samples helps to generate is a snapshot of any living creature. Hmm. So it's really a revolutionary tool now that's increasingly used to confirm the presence of elusive animals and also for conservation purposes. I prefer to work with, you know, a blood sample, a hair sample, but because eDNA tends to be very fragile because it is exposed to the elements. And so if it, you know, it's exposed to sunlight and rain and you don't really know how long it's been out there. So it's a little bit different than working with, blood or tissue or hair, which is the stuff that I'm normally used to working with. But it's still an incredibly cool tool to use, and that's being used more and more in the scientific community, especially when you're talking about elusive animals that you don't have the luxury of capturing for any of these samples.
So, and you found this under the tree structure that you were talking about previously. Mm-hmm. Do any other primates in the wild, in your experience, or that has it been documented that any other primates make something similar to that at all?
We know that orangs, for example, will put palms and stuff together, kind of forming a little bit of a hut, a little bit of a shelter over them. Gorillas will build these rather intricate, large nests that they sleep in, and they build a new one every night. So they just abandon the old ones. So we know that there's building of things involved with other primates. But I've got to tell you, I have never seen anything like this that has not been built by a human. So for example, if there's a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout in your life, you'll know that sometimes they practice making little shelters and that sort of thing. And I spent a great deal of time with the Bayaka in Congo. And I went on several like traditional hunts with them and that sort of thing. And they were able to really quickly put up these these structures, right? That provided like the perfect shelter for us to stay out there for several days at a time. And there's so much planning, forethought, and intricacy involved, not to mention opposable thumbs that it would require to put all this together. And honestly, you know, I can't tell you, I do not know what built what we were looking at. I cannot simply dismiss that a human could have built it, mm-hmm. right? A human could have very possibly been in that area and built it. I'm not sure why they would, because of the way that, because of the way it was built and where it was.
Yeah,
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you didn't pull like your Jeep over on the side of the road and it was there. You guys were in deep for that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we were very deep in the wilderness there. But the other thing is that there were elements about it. For example, there was this huge trunk or part of a trunk at the very top of this thing that would have required not just great strength to put up there, but a ladder, quite frankly. Like there was no way for some, you know, there were just certain things. So like I said, I don't know what built this thing. I can tell you that of the known animals that we know of in that area, none of them built it. So it was, again, it's an interesting find.
I kind of go through the mental gymnastics needed to when presented with all this evidence, like if there is this species of creature out there in North America, well, all over the world, but we're dealing with North America right now. I've read that there's like 33 million deer approximately in the United States. And mm-hmm. and so that would be like a food source for Sasquatch. In your estimation, if there is such a creature, just based on food and the amount of land necessary for them to either migrate or live undetected, mm-hmm. what would you say would be an approximate number of Sasquatch that could be out there? Would there be just thousands of them or tens of thousands or hundreds?
Oh my goodness.
Or hundreds, you know? I mean,
Sure. Oh, that is such a wild guess. What we look for in these areas, and certainly what I look for, is this an area that could sustain a potential large and apparently at least omnivorous, if not carnivorous animal, which by the way is also sort of bizarre because, you know, animals, the larger they are, the less likely they are to be carnivorous. So especially
really?
If you think about like gorillas, for example, they're herbivores, mm-hmm. right? They live in this giant salad bowl of a jungle and that's what they eat. Having said that, chimps, which are smaller, but still quite large, they will often hunt. And kill other primate species, in fact, you know, monkeys and such, and feed off that meat. So it's not unheard of. But I know that there's many reports of, you know, I guess Bigfoots being seen carrying off deer over their shoulder. And so they're known as hunters and predators in that way. So when we get to these areas, the first thing I think is, okay, is this an area that has a healthy, you know, enough population of, let's say, deer, water sources, habitat, shelter that could sustain such an alleged large animal. And all of the areas that we've gone to so far certainly could. And given the number of eyewitness accounts that come from these areas, and by the way, that's also one of the ways in which the areas that we go to are selected, right, is the number of reports and how recent they are and what kind of sightings they are. You know, I think that very easily you could be talking about thousands of animals that could be walking around. I mean, the other part to that is that in order to have a healthy, viable population of any species, you need genetic diversity. And this is where it sort of gets interesting because there are talks about migrations, which even in our own human lineage, we know to be true. And then there's also reports of different species, let's say, or different groups of maybe not species, but different groups of Bigfoots having different appearance, like hair color, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've recently gotten quite a number of people reaching out. Had I ever heard of a more of a yellow haired, which I personally had not. And then when I broached my expedition partners on this, they're like, oh yeah, yeah, there are reports of that. I'm like, really? So there's, and some are reported to be more reddish, more brownish, more blackish. And then there's the calls. Apparently there are sort of regional calls that have been identified. And again, it's hard to know what the source of those recordings are and what truly made those sounds. But for folks that are analyzing it and thinking they think they've got a Bigfoot call, apparently there is a regional, which we see with other, animal species. So it's quite, it's all within the realm of possibility, which is what makes it so both difficult and exciting for me.
Right. Oh, sure. I'm going to tread on this topic lightly here. When we're talking about Bigfoot population, there was one scene in one of the episodes where there was a thermal scan of something out there, and it looked like it was generating great heat in the front. And it was kind of mentioned that, well, perhaps if it is a Sasquatch, perhaps maybe it was pregnant. And so I was wondering about the reproduction of Sasquatch in relation to compare it to a chimpanzee. Do chimpanzees, what's their gestational time? Do they have just one offspring at a time?
So now I have to ask, who mentioned the pregnancy? Did I miss that? Ooh. I didn't say that.
No, I don't think it was you, but somebody, I'm sorry. I was just watching.
Okay.
They all kind of meld together. But there was something
that's
about,
okay.
Somebody just kind of mentioned that since the heat was directed in the front, perhaps it could have been explained that it was carrying something.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, that's the first I've heard of that. All I can say is that for gorillas, for example, their gestation period is 257 days.
Okay.
Chimps, 237 days, and orangs, 260 days. So we're talking about, with the great apes, an average of over 230 days.
Okay. So if a Sasquatch was in a mating season, if they reproduce, something like that, it would be safe to say that perhaps the gestational period would be similar to that?
I mean, possibly, but then again, if you look at humans, we don't have really a mating season, right? So, some people might argue that December is, because there's a lot of September babies. I know,
right.
I'm one of them.
Right.
So maybe that's the human mating season.
I was going to make a crude joke about,
go for it.
Miami and spring break might be a mating
season. Yeah. Well, that could be another, maybe that's a subspecies mating season. I don't know.
Funny.
That's funny. I'm going to have to rewatch an episode because I don't remember anyone talking about a pregnant Sasquatch. But that's, honestly, that's just a far-fetched guess.
Right.
Who knows? I just want to see the thing. I just want to prove that it exists. And then we can start getting into the behavioral and are they good? Are they good providers? Are they good parents? What's their social life like? Then we can get into the nitty gritty stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Well, I have you on the line. I was, like I said, watching all these shows. At one point in season one, I think the episode is even titled Human Bait. There's Native American.
Oh, right.
Yeah. There's Native American stories and folklore about forest brides and abductions that are blamed on Sasquatch. Whose idea was it for you to be used to
excellent question.
to be luring an alleged creature, and you seem fine with that. I mean, you got the expedition. I mean, you got the explorer's spirit. Whose idea was that? In retrospect,
that's hilarious. I thought it was a funny experiment, and I was totally game to go out there, but it was I believe that was Ronnie's idea.
Okay.
And see, people get mad at me for getting mad at Ronnie for chasing up a hill, but then no one got mad at Ronnie for putting me out there as bait.
And then in season two, you almost went spelunking down the shaft for the cave, exploring down in there because you were able to fit down there easier than I think.
Russ. I did. Right. I did. I went about 350 feet down underground and in fact made it to the very last level of, which was really interesting, disappointing in that we didn't find another entrance, but it was interesting nonetheless. We were hoping to see some sort of interconnectedness between the cave systems. But I think that was Ronnie's idea. Ronnie comes up with a lot of like wild ideas and, I for fun and also like just natural, I'm a very curious person and I sometimes go, wonder if that will work. So I let him play out there and do his thing because the truth is that in a weird way, this is a whole new kind of science, right? So I'm using what's tried and true and what I know and mm-hmm. what I'm familiar with. And there's no reason not to let him go with what, he wants to try and he's heard or has had work for him. So it's a good combination, but yeah, some of his ideas, sometimes I wear my heart on my sleeve and my reactions are very transparent. Sometimes apparently I make a face. Like he'll give me an idea and I'm like, huh. And I make a face and then like someone will say something to me. And I'm like, oh, did I say that out loud? Or like, did I really show that? But they're fun ideas. And his fun idea was to put me out there as bait because he'd heard that, I guess there's a lot of reports about, like you said, women getting kidnapped and by Bigfoots and taken by families of Bigfoots. So yeah, he thought, why not? We weren't having much luck in other ways. So let's just put her out and see what happens. But it was cool. And as anyone watching the show realizes, I was there with a cameraman.
Right.
Not to say that I wouldn't have gone out on my own, but I was out there with a cameraman who was, filming to see anything that would happen. And if a Bigfoot came up and ran off with me, it would have all been documented, which is what they'd want, right?
Yeah, for the sake of science, right?
It's in the name of science. And maybe that's why I'm okay with it. Like, hey, if that did it, then I'd go down in history as having proven it. I mean, I'd never get to talk about it, which would bum me out, but
yeah.
There you go.
Well, you're hardly the damsel in distress for sure. I mean, you're referred to as the female Indiana Jones,
Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. So like now that you're not looking for Bigfoot right now, right today, what is your day filled with? What are your pursuits right now until you get the call for a season three, if there's a season three?
You mean today? Like you want the honest glimpse into my day today?
No, not what you're having for lunch. But I mean, like, are you planning to go to another expedition to Africa? Are you,
Well, I'm going to have an exciting lunch, but I'll spare you that one.
Okay, right.
So here's my day to day, which is not very typical day to day because it changes all the time. Sort of like my expeditions. There's nothing typical about them. So I am the director of exploration and science communications at Florida International University. That's FIU in Miami. And so day to day, I'll have, different Zoom meetings like most of us are having these days, right? And planning all sorts of exciting things in the world of science communication with the university. I'm also the mother of six. My oldest is 15, my youngest is 5. And so, on a day to day, I'm a soccer mom, a dance mom, a baseball mom, an acting mom, because I have one who's really interested in acting. And so I I'm a wife. And so sometimes, not often I'll cook, not very often. But then there's the other side, which is where I'm planning my next expedition because I'm always thinking of that. And right now I've got one that I'm incredibly, I've got two. I'm excited about both of them. One is going back to Africa and one of my trips was canceled this last year. And so I'm rebooting that. But then the other one is a brand new one, and I can't give too much away, but it is going to be in pursuit of a species that has been deemed to have gone extinct. I can give you this much. It's out in Indonesia. Takes several days by boat just to get to the beginning of the area where we would start the search. And what's very cool and parallels what I'm doing now with Expedition Bigfoot is that it's in search of something that people think is no longer there, but that eyewitnesses, the locals, are very much still reporting on. So I'm going to be following all of these eyewitness accounts, which I've done that all throughout my career. In fact, there was a monkey in South America that I was searching for, and it was also thought to be locally extinct. And I would go from village to village, and, you know, one village would say, I haven't seen it in years. And then the next village would say, I haven't seen it in months, you know, on and on. I haven't seen it in weeks. And then I got to that last village where they were like, it's in our kitchen pot, you know, in our kitchen pot.
Wow.
And from there, I was actually able to find the living population that was in and around that surrounding area. So in that very same way, I'm heading off to find, I hope to find, this species that was deemed to be have gone extinct. And I'm hoping that that's not the case.
Sounds exciting.
And that we get a second chance. I'm super excited about it.
My goodness.
And I've never been on an expedition that I didn't love. And it's funny because as crazy, challenging, and difficult, and as horrible as an expedition may be while it's happening, I'm always thinking about the next one. Even in those moments, I'm like, this, like, it's still awesome, and I can't wait to go on the next one. And that's how I'm feeling right now. Like, this is going to be sort of epic.
I will be very excited to follow your career and where all this takes you. I'm very intrigued by this. This sounds incredible.
Thank you.
You know, to have you on the program, I talk a lot with different, like, paranormal experts and things like that. And we go down deep rabbit holes of Bigfoot, from everything from just being a forest creature all the way to an enchanted creature, to an alien, to the ghost of a Neanderthal. I really, really, mm-hmm. for my own formation and for my own interest, to have something that's so rooted in science and such a wonderful conversation with you. I just can't thank you enough for this opportunity to share time with you and to, you know, and to theorize and to speculate and just get to know you. It's just been a lot of fun.
It's been a great fun. Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
Yes. And if you ever make your way back to Omaha, I'll buy you a Coke at the treetop restaurant next to the,
Oh, sure. I'd love that.
At the rainforest.
I mean, I'm more of a Pepsi girl, but I'll take it.
Right on. Yeah. Well, Omaha has the largest indoor artificial rainforest. So that's the only rainforest that I've been in. So,
mm-hmm. They have a wonderful Madagascar exhibit.
Yes. I'm very lucky to be living in this city that has such a great zoo. And it's great.
It's awesome.
It's great that you spent time there. And it's great that you spent time with me. I so appreciate it. And I will be watching your career unfold and all these expeditions. And hopefully we'll see an Expedition Bigfoot season 3. And gosh, that'd be great to see some more evidence. It's very compelling. And you guys do a great job on the show.
Thank you so much. We really hope and we're excited to get back out there too. So maybe I'll have to come back and see you.
Very, very good. Everybody, I've had this wonderful opportunity to speak to Dr. Maria Mayer. She is the one of the lead investigators, researchers on Expedition Bigfoot, but there's so much more to her career. So look her up online. She's got a wonderful website. She's got books available. Dr. Mayer, thank you so much for everything.
Thank you so, so much. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
There we go, everybody. Episode 201 with Dr. Maria Mayer. What a distinguished guest. And how cool that we have that connection of the show being recorded and produced in Omaha and her studying for her PhD and working and researching at Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo. When in Omaha, please visit the Omaha Henry Dorley Zoo. They're not sponsors, but they should be. Next up on the Necronomicast, episode 202 is going to feature Amy Petula. Amy is the author of a fantastic book called The Corpsewood Manor Murders in North Georgia. So yes, we're going to go back into a little bit of true crime with Amy Petula. If you're not familiar with the Corpsewood Manor Murders in Georgia, oh man, what a story. Oh man, I can't wait to bring that one to you. Murder, mystery, LSD, Satanism. Yikes. That's what's in store for all of you for episode 202. Now, this episode is copyright 2021, all rights reserved. If you would be so kind to go to iTunes or wherever you go to listen to podcasts, the podcast app, and leave a review, a rating. Perhaps, if you're so inclined, go over to YouTube and subscribe to my channel. It's chock full of information that you just can't do without. I can see the sun peeking up over the horizon. It's going to be a beautiful day, everybody. Go get some sleep.